He's got a beautiful backswing.
Dad, oh, he got all of that one.
Oh my gosh.
That is amazing.
Layup with an iron into the hazard.
Well, that wasn't quite what I meant, you know?
Welcome in, everybody, to another edition of the 73rd Hole. I'm Colby Powell. Taylor Williams joins me, as always. Make sure you head over and follow us on social media, on Twitter, at the 73rd Hole. Instagram is 73rd Hole, and Facebook is the 73rd Hole Podcast. You can follow Taylor and I individually on Twitter, at Colby J. Powell, and at T_Williams101. We've got some great social media content in the way of video games coming your way the next couple weeks, so make sure you check that out on Twitter, especially at the 73rd Hole. And on Instagram, 73rd Hole. All right, we had a great interview on Monday with Taylor Gooch and Kelsey Klein, and the reaction to that has been phenomenal. We appreciate everyone tuning in there and all the love that we've been shown for the great interview that those guys gave us on Monday. We've got another one for you today. Another former Oklahoma State Cowboy, now a current Baylor Bear, the head coach of the Bears, Coach Mike McGraw, joins us now on the 73rd Hole. Coach, we appreciate you taking some time for us today. How you doing?
Great. Thank you very much for having me on today. I'm loving being here.
Absolutely. It's one of these things. It's a weird time right now, and we're able to interview some people that we otherwise may not have been able to because they would be busy. Things are different than they've ever been right now. And Coach, I'm just curious, during these times of quarantine, obviously the golf season being canceled, how are you personally handling this? And I know you've been a golf coach for probably about as long as you can remember. Every spring it's been golf, and now it's just nothing. So how are you handling this period of kind of nothingness?
Well, you try to fill it with something. So doing lots of reading, connecting with the players every day in some form or fashion, whether it's we're actually having a FaceTime call this afternoon with the entire team, but they get a text from me every single day. We talk about things, you know, what they're working on. I've got stuff within the athletic department we're still doing. So there's still plenty to do. It just doesn't feel the same for sure because you're not preparing for a tournament or at a tournament or coming home from a tournament. So yeah, that all feels very different, but it does for everybody in pretty much any industry. It doesn't matter what you're doing, any profession.
Yeah, absolutely, Coach. Yeah, and I know this spring is probably different than really probably any spring that you've had over the last, I don't know how many ever years of your career, because it seems like, you know, every March, April, May, especially, you're going to be out there, you know, with your players and getting after it at such an elite level like you have over in the past. So, you know, kind of going back onto all that, you know, kind of bring us back to, you know, when you first started coaching, you know, and kind of what got you involved in this great game that we all love, and kind of, and what's led you to the point to where you're at now?
Well, when I got out of when I got out of college, I decided to turn pro that summer and played mini tour golf sort of off and on for 3 years or so. Basically played for 3 years, but was the junior golf director at Kickingbird Golf Course and still gave a lot of golf lessons, worked in the golf shop a little bit, did everything I could to try to save up money. And from about October through February, I would go out and play mini tours either in San Diego or maybe Tucson or South Florida, and usually came home with my pockets empty, so I wasn't sure it was a job because they weren't paying me enough money to call it a job. And but all during that time, Art Proctor, who was the head golf professional at Kickingbird, encouraged me to still run the junior golf program, stay involved with junior golf, and I think Art's probably the biggest reason I became a coach, because when he was kind of encouraging my working with the youth there in Edmond and working with junior golf, even as I was trying to play. And then when I decided I wouldn't play anymore, it was a natural fit for me to kind of take junior golf and go from there and help the high school team. So I sort of give Art Proctor credit, because even though he didn't tell me to become a coach, he kind of made it very available for me to know that would be an avenue for me.
Yeah, so you got into the coaching game, and you started at the high school level, and people see where you are now, and a lot of people around here know you as for your time at Oklahoma State, but obviously you spent a lot of time at the high school level, so I'm curious, what are the biggest differences kind of that you saw throughout your career coaching high school and coaching collegiately? Because obviously it's a whole different level of golf. Coaching high school, you're looking at guys who, some of them want to play college, some of them don't. At the collegiate level, especially Division I, Oklahoma State and Baylor, you're looking at guys who want to keep playing and try to make money playing this game. So what did you notice were the biggest differences in your high school days and then as you moved on into college coaching?
Well, for one, the first big difference is when you're coaching high school golf, you basically know those kids from when I was running the junior golf program at Kickenbird. I knew them from age 8 or 9 or 10 all the way until they graduated from high school and still to this day. When you coach college golf, you meet them in the recruiting process. So you meet them when they're already a little bit further along. So that's one difference. Then the fact that there is recruiting in college is another big difference. There's travel. When you coach college golf, there's a lot more travel. You don't just hop in a little mini bus and go over to Midwest City and play at John Conrad. You actually get on a plane and go to Florida or California or Arizona, something like that. So travel's a lot different. And then resources that are available are so much different. And when we wanted new golf bags at Edmond North, we had 2 garage sales, 3 bake sales, and 2 car washes. And the kids pitched in and their parents pitched in. And before you knew it, we had a new Ping bag for everybody, but it wasn't without a lot of work. And it's not quite the same way when you coach college golf. So those are some of the differences. But to your point, just pretty much everybody that I bring on campus at least is still working toward wanting to one day be a professional golfer. That isn't always the case with high school players. They might give lip service to it, but then at some point that dream kind of starts going away when they're averaging 76 or something their senior year in high school or not even making the team, whatever that may be. So, but those are the differences between high school and college. The one thing that doesn't change is it's still coaching. It's still golf. It's still trying to motivate somebody to do the best they can do, be the best they can be, achieve their dreams, whatever those dreams may be. Because when Charles Howell shows up on campus and when little Jimmy Smith, or whoever he may be, is a freshman in high school, I don't think Jimmy Smith, I'm just picking a name, I don't think his dreams or goals or aspirations are any different than Charles Howell. I mean, he wants to be great. He wants to do great things. It's just that he might not have the talent. Maybe he doesn't understand the work ethic or what goes into it, and certainly may not have the resources to get himself to that spot. But my point is it's still coaching. So it's very much similar in that respect.
Yeah, absolutely. One thing I was kind of curious about, going from high school to college, did that give you a unique perspective whenever it came to recruiting, whenever you would walk into a parent's home, having spent so much time with the junior golf program and in high school? Do you think that felt like that helped you down the line whenever you were trying to recruit kids and get them to come play for you at the next level?
Well, when I went to Oklahoma State, I was served as an assistant coach for Mike Holder for 7 years, and every kid in Oklahoma, I had, that was any good at all at that time, we had a really good chance, if not the inside slot, at getting them, because I'd known all those kids. I'd coached against them. Many of them I'd given golf lessons to. I was the junior golf director at Kicking Bird, so I gave a lot of golf lessons to kids from outside of Edmond, actually, as well. So, yeah, I had a unique perspective in the sense that I knew all those families pretty much, or I knew people that knew them easily. We had an inside shot at getting some of those kids. And, I think it gave me a perspective on how to talk to a high school coach pretty well, because I had been a high school coach for so long. So, yeah, I think that was a unique perspective. A lot of guys, like Mike Holder himself, just went straight from trying to play for a living to being a college coach, and he'd never even served as an assistant coach. He just went straight in. So that's an unusual perspective as well. I literally had the perspective of talking to college coaches when I was a high school coach, trying to get them interested in my players. And yes, unique for sure.
Yes, absolutely, Coach. And, you know, you're given a great insight there, you know, kind of, you know, your recruiting process and kind of what you've learned through all that. And, you know, from just a firsthand experience, you know, from seeing you at numerous junior tournaments when I was younger, just going into anyone's mind who hasn't experienced it, you know, it's a very unique feeling when, you know, you just go out to your normal summer tournament, you're out on the range, you know, hitting your range balls, and all of a sudden you go back to change clubs and you look back and, oh, no, Coach McGraw's standing right there right behind you checking you out. So, you know, what is something, you know, when you're out there on the range, you're going to these junior tournaments, or when you're recruiting these players like you do, what are some things that you're looking for, whether it be from, you know, a technical standpoint, game-wise, or from a mental standpoint, attitude standpoint, anything like that? You know, what are you looking for when you're looking to recruit a player?
Well, first of all, I get there before daylight. So I'm there before any of the kids' cars pull into the parking lot. I kind of want to see how kids approach the practice area, how they come from the parking lot, what it looks like. I want to know what certainly how they're preparing everything they do before around a golf. So I want to see that, because I mean, if that kid comes and plays for me, I kind of want to know how that's going to look when he gets to college. I want to see them play poorly. And I know that sounds crazy, but I really like seeing bad golf from a junior golfer who I know is a good player. I don't like seeing bad golf from a kid who's an 18 handicap. I like seeing it from a player who I know is a good player. But then I get to watch and see how he handles bad golf, because he's going to play some bad golf for me at the collegiate level. So I want to know what that looks like. I want to know how he treats volunteers. I want to know how he treats the scorekeeper. I want to know how he treats his parents or whomever's there, his playing partners, just how he treats the game of golf. So I'm looking for all those things. If I've done my job ahead of time, I should have a pretty good idea that he's at least a good player. He's got talent. He's had good finishes. I see kids, I don't like to babysit them. I used to, where I'd watch all 18 holes and then of all three rounds, and then watching the next week and the next week, try to outwatch the other coaches, which is a silly, silly waste of your time. I like to watch 2 to 3, 4 holes at a time. And, you know, I'd just like to see a kid over a 5 or 6 tournament stretch over a whole summer, see how he performs that way. So I'm looking for trends. I'm looking for consistency in the way he handles things. You're just looking for all those things that you can't really see in a resume or on a results sheet or a leaderboard someplace. Even though, you know, if the guy's consistently at the top of the leaderboard, there's something there. But the point is I want to see, a lot of times there's more to it than just what you see on the leaderboard.
Longtime golf coach, high school, Oklahoma State women's and men's, now the Baylor men's head golf coach, Mike McGraw, joining us here on the 73rd hole. Coach, I want to know, you get to Oklahoma State, you're an assistant for a while, you coach the women's team for a year, and then you get named the head men's golf coach at Oklahoma State, one of the premier programs in the country. What was that moment and that feeling like? Take us back to that moment and what you were feeling that day when you were named the head coach at Oklahoma State.
Well, I was feeling the weight of about, at that time, 55 years of great, great golf. But the truth is, I should never have been there. I should not have had that position. I'm not supposed to be there on that moment. I knew it, because 8 years earlier, when Mike Holder had hired me as an assistant coach, he was doing it sort of as a favor to me. I'd known Mike since I caddied for him as a boy. And he was doing it as a favor to try to get me a head coaching job someday. And I thought of it as a great gesture on his part to do that for me. But he told me that day, Mike, don't have any design on being the head coach at Oklahoma State. You will not be the head coach at Oklahoma State. Whoever replaces me will be an Oklahoma State alum. And so I didn't ever even dream that I would be the coach at Oklahoma State. And 8 years later, when he became the athletic director, his first hire was to hire any coach, was to hire me and as the men's golf coach. So it was a shock to me, a wonderful shock, but I was never supposed to have that job. But I think Mike told me that day that there were two things that that allowed him to make that decision pretty easily that day. One, he understood how hard I worked, and he had seen that every day for 8 years. And number two, so he felt comfortable handing his baby over to the guy who would work hard, at least. And then also, one of the things in a interview process that you can't truly get from a resume or even just an interview face to face one day is character. And Mike felt like after 8 years, he kind of knew my character at that point. So those two things pushed him over the top. He thought, you know, I could search the country to try to find another coach, but I don't think I'll find one better, which was a great compliment to me. And, you know, I thanked him greatly for that. I thanked him 8 years later when he fired me. I thanked him for the opportunity he had given me, because that was kind of unprecedented. He told me he would never do it, and he did it. So I guess you asked what was I feeling on that day. It was like, this is not supposed to be happening, but I'm so thrilled that it is. And I had a good friend of mine who's an Oklahoma State graduate, not a golfer, who called me up that afternoon when he had heard that I'd been hired as the head golf coach. And he said, gosh, Mike, I'm so excited for you. I'm just thrilled for you. I can't believe that my best friend is going to be the golf coach at Oklahoma State, a place I love. So he was just going on and on and on. And then, so I was thanking him, and a few minutes later, he finally said, can you tell me something? What was the name of the guy that replaced John Wooden at UCLA? And I said, gosh, I don't know. And he goes, well, what about the guy who was at Green Bay right after Vince Lombardi? And I said, I don't know. And he said, well, what about the guy who replaced Bear Bryant? And I said, whoa, whoa, whoa. I understand where you're going with this.
Oh, no.
Anyway, so that was part of it where I really, really hit home. Like, I'm replacing an icon, and this is going to be a really, really important moment in Oklahoma State golf history. I've got to show that, you know, that I can keep this thing going. And but to answer your question, original question, yes, I was kind of shocked that I had that opportunity that day. Totally thrilled.
Yeah, that's fabulous insight there from you, Coach. You know, knowing, you know, from when you, like you said, you took the assistant job and didn't even necessarily think you even had an opportunity to get that head coaching job and to eventually get it, you know, kind of like you mentioned from your character standpoint, which you feel like got you there, which, you know, anyone that's met you, you know, hasn't had a bad word to say about you. One of those being Taylor Gooch, one of your former players that we had on our last interview earlier this week. And he made a point to emphasize that during his freshman year, you had walked essentially every round with him and was almost like a caddy in a sense. The only thing he didn't do as a caddy would be to carry his clubs, obviously. So kind of take us through that process, you know, of, you know, not even just that specific year with Taylor, but have you done that with other freshmen in the past or other players, or was that just, you know, a specific case for him, or do you kind of just get a feel on when you should do that with a player? Just kind of take us through that process.
Well, it does change from year to year, but normally I like to see a freshman close up, play golf for several rounds of competitive golf in a row. And so I might end up walking with him, you know, one tournament or two or three. And this fall I walked with our freshman, Johnny Kiefer from San Antonio. I saw every shot he hit this fall. And this spring I followed him, I followed him both tournaments in the spring. I basically have seen Johnny play every competitive round with the exception of one of the match play rounds, the Big 12 Match Play Championship. The reason I do that is because I want to get to know the player. I want to get to know his weaknesses, his strengths, how he handles good things, how he handles bad things, decision-making processes that he's going through. It's kind of crazy, but I'll actually let kids make mistakes. And I did listen to your podcast with Taylor and Kelsey. And Kelsey, I texted Taylor and I said, you did a really nice job on that podcast. He said, yeah, and I mentioned you and how you walked with me as a freshman. I said, oh, okay. And he said, do you remember anything that happened in my first tournament that I think I should remember or I learned from? And I said, number 12, immediately. And he goes, you're right. Well, that was a perfect example of I'm walking with a freshman in his first tournament. He's playing great. He's one under par. And he's going into the 12th hole, and he flares a tee shot into the right trees, and he's got no shot whatsoever. The only thing he's got is a little pitch down to about 100 yards. I stood over here, I said, Taylor, where I'm standing, this is 100 yards from the flag. If you can just pitch it down here, we'll still get it up and down for par. And he said, no, come here, coach. And I said, what? And he said, I think I can hit it over there. And he's pointing to this area that couldn't have been more than 20 square feet in diameter completely. And it's surrounded by trees, and it's this one little patch of kind of mown grass. But his ball is 7 inches above his feet, in 4 inches of rough with trees and wind blowing off the left. and he's going to try to fit this little shot over a hazard, by the way. And he's going to try to do that just to gain about 40 yards and get it in the spot where he's still not going to hit the green. And I thought, so he explained to me where he wanted to hit, and I thought, I've got to let him make this mistake. I hate to do this, but I have to let him make this mistake, because if I make him pitch it down there to 100 yards and he doesn't get it up and down for a par, he'll be really upset. Gosh, I would have made a par if the coach would have let me hit it over that hazard. So anyway, I let him hit the shot, didn't even doubt him, knocked it right in the hazard, makes a double, and we talked about it at the end of the round. But the idea was, now I wouldn't do that at the conference championship. Let's get one thing straight.
This was now he told us the story off the air. This was Olympia Fields his freshman year, right?
Yeah. And we're not doing that late in the season, in postseason, because it's too late to be learning that lesson. But you want to teach that lesson early on. And if a kid has that mindset where he thinks he can pull off that shot when he's got not gaining anything by pulling it off, I need him to learn this lesson now. And he told me the other day, he said, you know, I've carried that lesson with me my entire career. Now, I mess up sometimes, but that was a turning point in, you know what, there's a difference between being aggressive or, you know, excitable or, you know, daring or bold and stupid. He said, I was just being stupid and it was just dumb. And so I think walking with a player right there, I can get that sense. I didn't get that in junior golf, because in junior golf, they played the ball up in Oklahoma. They played short golf courses. He'd just drive it down there about 20 yards from the green, chip it on, two putt for his par, and move on to the next hole. There wasn't a lot of strategy involved, and there wasn't certainly a lot of challenging situations for a junior golfer when you grow up and you're winning everything by five or six shots. So my point is that's the reason I walk with one player, and usually a freshman, an inexperienced player, or a player playing his first tournament. You want to find out how they handle these situations. So maybe you've got a teaching opportunity at the end of the round or at the end of the tournament. If I'm just seeing a guy on par three tee boxes three or four times around, hand him a bottle of water, pat him on the shoulder, tell him he's doing great, that's sort of cheerleading more than anything. It's not really coaching. And so this way I actually get to one, have an impact on the score for the team that day, but two, learn about the player. And it seems to have worked through the years. And Mike Holder actually did that at Oklahoma State. Alan Bratton, I think, still does it at Oklahoma State. I do it at Baylor. So I think a lot of other coaches are doing it now, too. In fact, at the final round at Cabo, we were playing in a foursome and with Texas A&M, Stanford, and Oklahoma State. This is a month ago. And I walked with all three coaches, all 18 holes. So all three of those coaches, just like me, stayed with their player the whole round. I thought, you know, that's pretty significant. I think that most coaches are realizing there's some value there.
Yes, I completely agree, Coach. I remember from a lot of my junior tournaments, and it used to irritate me a little bit. You know, my college coach didn't do as much as some of the other ones, but it seemed like a lot of them would just stand on, like, par three tee boxes and, you know, try to give club decisions. And for me, that was something I didn't necessarily agree with, because one of the reasons, because statistically par threes are the least important when it comes to par four and par five, but that's off a different subject. So I completely agree with the approach that you have there. And a couple of different questions to get here. One, you know, have you ever had, because you mentioned you wanted to stay with freshmen, mainly, have you ever had a younger team where you had maybe two or three different freshmen, you kind of had to choose which player that you wanted to follow and kind of had to pick and choose there? And then, you know, obviously if Taylor has, you know, a memory that's lasted with him so long about course management, has taught him such a valuable lesson to where now he's on the PGA Tour, can you think of any other instances where it comes to course management that you've learned or that you've shared onto other players that have had success that may have, you know, got them along the lines?
Well, you mentioned, have you ever had where you had two or three freshmen on the same team? Well, yeah, I did. I had Kevin Sway and Ricky Fowler and Mark Johnson.
Those guys any good?
Yeah, that's not a bad threesome to have there.
That was pretty good. So, you know, a lot of times you'll have your assistant coach go with a player. A lot of times, when Pablo Martin was a freshman, we didn't walk with him very much. Pretty outstanding. Charles Howe was a freshman. Mike Holder walked with him a little bit, but actually, when Charles was in his third year, when he won the NCAA championship by eight shots, Mike walked every shot with him. So I think you just you just figure out where you're going to get the most bang for your buck. Are you going to have a guy that's struggling that really needs you there to calm him down? If you got a guy that's playing great, you've been walking with him and he doesn't want you to leave his side, okay, you just get the lowest score you possibly can out of him. Or are you just trying to find out, like at one tournament where you might walk with one guy one round, a different guy the second round, and a different guy the third round, where you get to know guys and you have your assistant coach do the same, basically, where you're kind of finding out about your team. Certainly it'll look different early in the year than it will late in the year, because early in the year is when you're trying to do as much teaching as possible. You're trying to find out as much as you can about as many players on your team as you can. So I feel like I know Johnny Kiefer's game now. And if he asks me to walk with him, and by the way, if a player wants you to walk with him, it doesn't matter who I've been walking with. If a player requests, then I'm going to. And I'll tell the other guy, hey, you know, Johnny wants me to walk with him today. Are you good with that? Oh, yeah, coach, go ahead. I'm fine. And you don't want a kid dependent upon you anyway. You don't want him. You don't want to be enabling a kid. You want to be learning as much as you can so you can have intelligent conversations after the round. So as much learning can take place as possible, as much coaching, as much teaching. And then you get them ready for the time where you just let them go. You don't want a kid expecting you to walk with him. You don't want a kid thinking you have to have the coach with you to play well. That's not what you want. You want it the opposite.
Yeah, Coach Mike McGraw joining us here on the 73rd hole. Coach, I'm curious, in 2009 is when the match play format was instituted to determine the national champion in college golf. You had some great teams around that time, and in 09, 10, and 11, Oklahoma State finished T5, second, and T3 at the national championships. How did you feel initially back then, and then how do you feel today about match play determining the national champion in college golf?
Well, I think more than anything, it has to be your attitude. So, to me, whatever format we are playing, it's the greatest format in the world. It has to be, because it is the format you're playing. If they tell me that all five guys are going to go out in the parking lot and all five Auburn guys are going to go out in the parking lot and the team that has the last guy standing wins, then we're going to go to the wrestling coach or the boxing coach or the MMA coach or whomever and find out how to be the toughest, strong. If that was the format, that's what I'm going with.
Well, you probably recruit a little different too.
I probably would recruit differently. But the point is, and that I'm going to try to get to now, is a lot of fans, alumni, people interested in Oklahoma State golf at the time were really, really upset that we went to match play. And I was fighting the battle of, okay, you know what? I love stroke play, and I think the best team over 72 holes has a better chance. I mean, there's no question in my mind, last spring in Arkansas, Oklahoma State won the stroke play by 31 shots. If they weren't the best team in the country, I don't know who is. And over 72 holes, they were going to win the national championship. And I had a couple of teams there, same thing early on in match play. But we don't win the match play portion of it, which Oklahoma State didn't last year, and three straight years I had the number one team in the country to not win them. To after the fact gripe, moan, and whine about it is the most silly, ridiculous thing of all time, because you knew the format going in. And so I never, ever was upset about the format, ever. The only thing I would have changed is I would have made the matches at stroke play. So my 72 beats your 73. And that way and I get the point for the team. That way all five matches get to number 18. And then your crowd builds and the excitement builds. And people want to argue that match play is more exciting than stroke play. Maybe, because there is a winner, a loser, or it's tied on every single hole. So you have an outcome on every hole. So there is some more pressure there for sure. But if I've got a two-shot lead on the 17th tee or a three-shot lead on the 17th tee at Carson Creek, is that a safe lead in stroke play for two holes against my opponent? I don't think so. So my point is I think it could be just as exciting, and that was the only issue I ever had with it. I love the head-to-head format. I love going from 30 teams down to 15, then down to 8 after the 72-hole cut, and then head-to-head going. I think it's great. So I love the format. It did not – I think it's cost Oklahoma State probably – 3 national championships for sure, but it's okay. All those teams, every single team that Oklahoma State took to the national championship, 2 or 3 of mine, and then last year Allen Bratton's team, they knew the format going in, and they knew it was going to be match play. So to be upset about match play format is not, it's a pretty weak argument, because that's just the format. That's what you've got. If you don't like the format, change it. But I'm okay with the format. I actually like it.
Yeah, then that's a great point there you make, Coach. I do think that, you know, because like you said, no, not even on 17 at Carson, no two-shot lead is good on any hole out there at Carson, so anything can happen. So I do think, you know, maybe a stroke play, you know, implementation instead of just a hole-by-hole might end up making that even a better championship than it is now. But, you know, go back to, you know, like I said, you've had so many teams that were so good in the stroke play and then going into the match play. Was there any type of different preparation you had for your players, you know, whether it be, you know, like normally with like me and my college coach, you know, we'd go over course management, you know, before the night, you know, and kind of figure out how to play, you know, each hole and try to stick to that same game plan. How did your prep with your players change as soon as you went from that stroke play component to the match play part?
Well, it didn't change enough is the problem. I don't think I focused enough on match play. I really don't. Here at Baylor, we have instituted a tournament we call the Bear Cup. It's just an internal, you know, within the team match play event that we have in the winter or spring to just play a bunch of match play. And it's a round robin. So you just keep playing and playing and playing until the last day and there's a champion crown. But I believe that had in those great years when we really had some great teams, if we had done more match play at home, I think we might have been better. Because it is such a different format. And looking back on it, we didn't play enough, and I didn't get them ready for that. But I still believe we had the team all 3 years that should have won the national championship. So it's on us. You know, we can look back on it. And Peter Uihlein was the number one ranked amateur in the world and number one ranked college golfer. And his opponent both years in 2010 and 11 was Patrick Reed. And, you know, I think we got to see firsthand just what kind of a ruthless killer that guy is.
Yeah, especially in match play formats, yeah.
Yeah, he's such a great competitor. It's unbelievable. But I'm going to say this. It was on us, Oklahoma State. We should have won those, at least one or two of those three national championships. We had the best team all 3 years, and the third year we were at home. So I feel like that's on us. We should have won. We didn't. So I make no excuses. None of my players ever make excuses. That was the way it was. We didn't play well enough to win. We should have.
Yeah, and I remember, Coach, you know, we talk about the teams that should have won and didn't. Let's talk about the teams that did. You were an assistant coach on the 2000 Oklahoma State team, and then you were the head coach. It was your first year as a head coach in 2006, both times when Oklahoma State won the national championship. What is that feeling like whenever you're standing there and you wrap it up, you've won the national championship, all that hard work pays off? Take us back to that feeling, and what's the difference as an assistant and as a head coach winning those national titles?
Well, as an assistant coach, I was only at that time 3 years removed from being the head coach at Evan North. And I knew I was going to Oklahoma State to try to get another head coaching job someplace else. And I knew Oklahoma State had a great team at the time. But still, winning a national championship is not an easy task. And I stood on the 18th green, the 72nd, after the 72nd hole. And we had just won a playoff with Georgia Tech. And I was stunned. Because here I was, this young kid from Ponca City, Oklahoma, who had played, you know, Division II or NAIA golf at Central Oklahoma, coached high school golf for years. And here I was holding a national championship trophy with Charles Allen, Edward Lohr, and, you know, their teammates, J.C. DeLeon from Tulsa, by the way. But there I was holding that trophy. I was stunned. I couldn't believe it. We won a national championship. And we had finished runner-up the year before when we really should have won. But so I was stunned there. At Oklahoma State, I wasn't stunned. It was more relieved because I felt the pressure taking over that job, and I knew what it was going to be like. So to be able to get that out of the way my first year was pretty spectacular and pretty relieving, if you will. So one year I was stunned, the other I was relieved, and then a lot of other years I was disappointed because I felt like we should have won and did not.
Remind us of some of the names on that 2006 team, if you would, that you won the national title with.
Yeah, Pablo Martin, who was as close as anybody I've ever seen to being Seve Ballesteros. I mean, Pablo just had a unique way of playing the game. It was so much fun to watch. So, and then Jonathan Moore, who's working with the Oklahoma State golf team today. Jonathan won the national championship that year. He played his last three tournaments, 34 under par, won them all.
Oh, man.
Jonathan was just amazing that year.
He was on a roll.
And then Zach Robinson, who was from Fort Worth, Texas, who really, I had a unique relationship with Zach because I was the assistant coach when we got him. That's a whole other story. But Zach Robinson, and then brothers, Tyler and Trent Leon from Dallas, who were the first brothers to ever anchor a national championship team. So I believe that's what we've figured out. But so that was the five, great group of guys that, you know, fought through a lot and really actually had a very good year. Didn't win until the spring, but we won five times that spring, and then just went on a run after the conference championship. We won everything after that and played great. So good team.
Yeah, fabulous team, and you've had so many fabulous teams over the years, Coach. And you know, you've talked about all your great experience at Oklahoma State, and you know, look, we can transition to where you're at now at Baylor University down in Waco. And you know, a lot of people can say it, and you know, like kind of the, you know, football, basketball, those kinds of sports, where you know, like if a coach can succeed at one place, you know, that's okay. But once you have success at multiple places, that's when you kind of know how great a coach can be. And you know, ever since you've been at Baylor, the university has seen their most golf success that they've had. Is it three or four straight now appearances in the NCAA championships?
The last four years. Yeah,
last 4 years, and absolutely tremendous. So my question to you, sir, is you know, what exactly has changed in the program at Baylor from day one that you got there? What were some of the things that you saw that need to be addressed, changed, and then how did you implement those to get the program to where it is now at such a high standard?
Well, one, I had to try to get some kids to believe that we should be able to do this. This is not something that's out of the realm. So you kind of have to get them to think a little differently. That's number one. But we actually had to have different facilities. Our practice area, which had a building with hitting bays and coaches' offices and a bathroom, no locker room actually, was on a range of a golf course about 25 minutes from campus. So that wasn't very convenient. We did have memberships at a country club, which we still have. But as far as the practice area, it was 25 minutes from campus. So I knew that needed to be addressed. And fortunately, some donors stepped up in a big way. And we, in basically 3.5 years, raised the money, because we need to raise every penny to build it, but raised the money to build it debt-free. We didn't borrow any money. We didn't use any university funds, all donor-funded projects. In fact, it's the first fully funded by donors capital athletic project in the history of the university. And we built that in 3.5 years and have a wonderful clubhouse, and it's about a two-minute drive, maybe 2 minutes, maybe a little less from the guys' apartments. So it's right on campus. Great. We took care of facilities. Now we've got a great facility, which is awesome. But the other thing is I inherited a team that had 6 international players out of 12 kids. And international kids are a lot of things. One, they're usually very appreciative for the opportunity. Two, they're almost always hardworking. They value an education, and they're making a great sacrifice to go halfway across the world to come over. So there's a lot of great things about international golfers. But some things about international, and I would still may recruit some in the future, but when I got here, I didn't think that was the best path for us, because Waco is in the geographical center of Texas, correct? Right in the center.
Yes, just right there. Yeah, so much talent around the Texas area, and then even, as you know, up in the Oklahoma area too, so you got a nice pipeline here, to say the least.
Right. The point I was going to make was it's in the geographical center of a state that for the last 50 years has produced at least the first, second, or third best junior golfers in the country. Florida, California, and Texas. I've been producing those players for 50 years. Texas has the most World Golf Hall of Famers. You could add up all the other states in the union, and they wouldn't add up to what Texas. So Texas is a hotbed for golf, for sure. And so I thought if Waco's in the geographical center of that state, and that state keeps on producing great players, and Waco is halfway in between Dallas and Austin, or basically halfway between Dallas and San Antonio, basically halfway between Dallas and Houston. And all those junior golfers from those great towns have to pass through Waco because I-35 runs through our campus. So I was just doing a little geography, and I realized these kids are going to be coming past my campus. They can't help but at least know where Waco is. So the second thing I did, other than addressing facilities, was to address recruiting in the state. Now, I'm going to get my nose bloodied quite a bit because there's a lot of great, great universities with awesome programs and superior, great coaches. So it's not like I can just snap my fingers and I've got all these players. That's not it at all. But I've made the effort to recruit Texas kids. And so the last 2 years before this one that we're currently in, the last 2 years, all 9 players on the squad were from Texas. And this year, 8 out of 10 are from Texas. But the last 3 straight years, all 5 players in the lineup from the state of Texas. So now that's talking about Texas, and you guys are up there in Oklahoma. And, you know, I've been trying to get players from Oklahoma, but I got to tell you, Alan Bratton and Ryan Hibble are pretty tough to recruit against.
That's to say the least, yes. They're doing a great job as well.
And I'm not the sharpest knife in the drawer. I'm not the dullest one either. So if a great player grows up in the state of Oklahoma and he sends me an email, okay, there's some interest or he wouldn't have sent me the email. But I always ask the question right up front. Now, be honest with me, if a state school that happens to be a highly ranked school decides that they want you to come to their school, what chance in the world do I have of getting you to come all the way down to Waco, Texas? I don't. And so I'm just going to be smart about how I use my recruiting time and, you know, how I use my resources and what I, you know, but just understand, I want to recruit in Oklahoma. And I tell all those kids that, but let's make it make sense. You know, you got to give me the compelling reason why I need to come up there and show interest. And so I have that conversation early because I want to be honest with kids and I want them to be honest with me. So, you know, yeah, you're right, coach. You don't really have a chance, or I'm wide open right now. Let's see if we can make this happen.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's you mentioned saving your resources and doing all that. So that's absolutely fabulous. And going back to showing, you know, some of your great prowess there, coach. And I was curious as well, you mentioned now that you've had, you know, a lot more Texas players, you know, kind of guys that are kind of growing up in the same environment, same culture, that, you know, mm-hmm. kind of thing. Have you noticed like your team chemistry, has it increased since you've become a coach? Just because everyone may be on the same, you know, like playing field, you know, like I said, culturally wise, you know, whenever you have so many different internationals, you know, you can get, you know, different cultures and different things in there to where, you know, there might not be as much, you know, camaraderie as you may have now. So have you noticed that aspect change since you've been there?
Well, I have. And before I answer that question, I want to make it very clear. International kids are great. I mean, I told you that from the start. They do a lot of great things. But if I'm talking to a rancher in West Texas who went to Baylor and he can't pronounce any of the kids' names on my team, you know, that's probably not going to be really great in his eyes. So I want to at least make the effort to recruit here. And to answer your question, yes. This year's team probably had the best team chemistry and synergy of any team I've coached in 35 years. So it was very close, if it wasn't the best. It was really, really good. And these kids grow up competing against each other, or you might have a senior on the team who competed against somebody who's a freshman, or they compete against brothers, or they've known each other, they've stayed in each other's homes, they've whatever. They just get to know each other a lot better growing up. And they have the same culture, the same backgrounds, the same food, the same type of golf courses, in the same weather, the same, you know, basic morals and values and ethics and things that, you know, are pretty normal and standard in Texas. They've all experienced that. So it does definitely help make my job easier. Yeah, but it doesn't mean I won't go outside the state. I mean, next fall I've got one kid from Texas, but I also have a kid from Oklahoma coming. So I have one from Chicago this fall that we just, you know, the year we just had. So it's not that I wouldn't go outside the state. I will, but it's just easier to start here.
Yeah, absolutely. And you mentioned this year's team, Coach. I'm looking at the golf rankings right now. You all were ranked 10th in the country. And, of course, the season has been canceled. But the NCAA did vote to give an extra year of eligibility to any seniors who this would have been their final season if they are a spring sport athlete. So did you have any seniors on this year's team who were in your starting five? And if you did, are those guys planning to go ahead and move on in their golf careers? Or do you know if they're coming back? Or how are you kind of handling this, you know, kind of once in a lifetime, very unique situation?
Right. I had two seniors, and they were senior co-captains. Cooper Dossie, who should be, I believe, probably, he'll be an All-American this year, and then Colin Cover. Cooper's from Austin, Colin's from Dallas. So those two guys came to me about two and a half weeks ago and said, Coach, what do you think the NCAA is going to do? And I said, I have no idea. My hope is that they give you guys a year back, but if they don't, we'll all live with it. It's fine. We'll roll with the punches. And they said, well, we've already made a decision. If the NCAA grants us a year of eligibility, we're coming back. And I said, okay, wow, really? And they go, yeah. And even if they don't allow the school to pay for it, you know, on the scholarship portion of it, we're going to pay our own way. So I thought that was an incredible gesture for those guys and great leadership to do that well before the NCAA made their decision. And then now the NCAA has made the decision to grant them another year. It's been pretty awesome that their teammates were pretty excited when they made that commitment, because it's like, we have unfinished business and we want to come back and take care of that before we move on to our pro careers. And then the NCAA came up with a decision this week, and so it fit right in nicely with what their decision was and what their sentiment was. So yeah, those two guys were the seniors. They're coming back and should help us be a much better team.
That's fabulous. And yeah, you guys are going to have even a more loaded roster than you have next year, Coach. And you know, that'll kind of lead into my next question I'm very curious about, because, you know, anyone that's met you can rave about, you know, your memory, you know, and how easy it is for you to recall facts, players, you know, even a shot like you just did about Taylor at Olympia Fields back on his 12th hole his freshman year. And so I'm just kind of curious, you know, out of all the players that, you know, not even players that you've coached for, even players that you've coached against, you know, what are some of the, you know, characteristics, you know, like you mentioned, some of the things you look for on the range, how they handle their attitude, and, you know, how they prepare themselves, how they handle bad times. And Taylor mentioned last week, you know, his game started to transcend when he started to make this, you know, determining effort, you know, change his diet, change his whole practice routine, everything like that. What are some things that you see from guys either in your program or guys that you play against that are able to succeed and get to that next level and be really successful pros, as compared to the guys who even, you know, come in, may have tons of talent, but start to, you know, fizzle out and don't get as far as they should based off of their talent level?
Well, the first thing I'll say to answer your question is this. If you cut the guys who have played the tour, guys who have gone on to the next level, the guys who have been successful in the world of golf, if you cut them open and ripped out their heart, inside that heart you would see the DNA of a golfer. In other words, I'm a golfer. That's what I'm going to be. That's what I'm going to do. I'm not doing anything else. Yeah, I'm getting this degree as a backup, but I don't need that backup. I'm a golfer. I'm going to play the game of golf. So the point is, it's inside their DNA is golfer. That's the DNA they have. And so now they all look differently doing it, because you had Charles Howell, who hit balls for about 8 hours a day. You had Ricky, who hit balls for 30 minutes and then played the rest of the day. You had Peter Uihlein, who, you know, with a little bit in between those two. And then, you know, so what I'm saying is, you've just had all different kinds of guys who end up playing the PGA Tour that got there differently. But again, all of them believe they were going to be a golfer. Now, you asked for characteristics. So I feel like number one is perseverance. And that, to me, is just going from failure to failure to failure to failure. Boom, something good happened. Okay. But I was able to keep my resilience up. I was able to keep my enthusiasm up from failure to failure to failure, and all of a sudden I succeeded. It makes it all worth it. You know, I don't know, Charles Howell went from 2007 to 2018 before he won another golf tournament. I mean, that's 11 years he toiled and went. Now, he still played pretty good during that 11 years.
Yeah, he was able to keep his tour card every year, and, you know, able to make the top 125 on the money list and the FedEx Cup when it came along. So, you know, even though he wasn't getting those wins, he was still able to keep his floor on his game was very, very high.
evolve. Yeah, but that's what I'm saying is just your perseverance, your ability to keep enthusiasm and love for what you're doing. So perseverance. And then that second one is love. I absolutely love the game of golf. I enjoy it so much. This is what I want to do. It gives me, you know, a great feeling when I go out and work at the game of golf. So if they don't love the game, they're not going to last for a long, long time, because those failures and those disappointments and those bumps in the road, you don't survive those, and you end up doing something else if you don't love the game of golf. So the guy that can persevere and hang in there, a guy who loves the game, and then obviously the DNA is in there that I'm a golfer. But other than that, I mean, I think they all look so different that it's just, I mean, I think you look at Matthew Wolf and you look at Victor Hovland, who are two guys that are rookies. They both won now in the PGA Tour. I think Victor is going to be a little steadier, and I think Matthew's going to be a little more up and down, but they're both going to be pro golfers for a long, long time. And it's because that's what they do. They're golfers, and they're really talented. You know, one other characteristic I think would be work ethic, that you do have a desire to get up every day, but that's part of the love for the game. If you love the game, your work ethic is going to be better if you truly love the game. So those are just some of the characteristics, I think, that set those guys apart. And then I guess I'm going to throw talent in there, because you have to have some talent, but you and I both have talent. We're working for a living, okay? So for some reason, we didn't develop our talent or our skills to the level where we could get to the PGA Tour. If you look at it, Zach Johnson is still playing world-class golf. He's still a professional golfer. But when he was a junior in high school, he called up his Iowa coach. All he ever wanted to do is play for the Iowa Hawkeyes, nothing else. And that coach said, what do you need there, young man? He says, well, I want you to know, coach, I want to walk on at Iowa. And that coach, whose team was ranked about 100th in the country, not a great team, said, well, you're not good enough to play here. You need to go someplace else. So Zach Johnson wasn't good enough, in the coach's opinion, to walk on at Iowa. He went to Drake, played their number two slot, and he ended up playing many tours. Then he ended up playing the Nationwide Tour. Then he ended up winning on the Nationwide Tour. And then he ended up getting his PGA Tour card. And the next thing you know, he's a two-time major champion and a Hall of Famer. Going to be a Hall of Famer. If that guy can do it, then it has something to do with perseverance. It has something to do with developing your skills, developing your talent. So, talent we all got. Those guys that develop it because of all these other characteristics I said, but they develop it, those are the guys that make it.
Yeah, Zach Johnson's about the perfect example you could pull on that one, Coach. Head Coach Mike McGraw joining us, the current Baylor head coach and the longtime Oklahoma State head coach. And you mentioned Charles Howell and Ricky Fowler, a couple of guys that you were around and coached and went on to have great success, fame, and fortune at the next level at the PGA Tour. And you're clearly a great storyteller, so I want your best Charles Howell story you can tell off the top of your head and the best Ricky Fowler story you can tell off the top of your head. I think our listeners would really enjoy those.
Okay, Charles Howell. I was the assistant coach when Charles Howell was on the team. In fact, I got to campus as a brand new employee for Oklahoma State about 2 months before Charles showed up. And Charles was the best junior golfer in the country. It wasn't even close. He was by far the best. And so everybody just assumed that Charles would play in the lineup. And we had a qualifying for the first tournament. And Coach Holder said, hey, guys, we're playing for four spots. So the four best scores in this 72-hole qualifying will automatically get to go. And then the coaches are going to pick the last spot. So we finished the qualifying, and Coach Holder named off the top four scores. And then he said, the coaches pick? Coaches pick. I think Coach McGraw and I will think about this overnight and tell you tomorrow at a team meeting. So we were going to leave him in suspense. I don't know if that was because he really didn't know who he was going to pick, or if he just wanted to make him sweat it out. But Charles Howell was number six in that qualifying. So the best junior golfer in the country is a freshman. He's homesick, not playing well, not happy, whatever. He's just not playing well, and he's six. So I guess some people assumed that they thought Mike Holder might pick him. So anyway, before the team meeting, Charles came into our office, and I'm sitting there minding my own business at my assistant coach's desk. And Charles is asking Coach Holder, he's pleading with him. I said, Coach, who are you going to pick today? I mean, I've just got to go. You know, I think everybody in Georgia, they expect me to play. Everybody in the country is watching. They've just got to. And he said, so you think you ought to go? He said, yes, sir. I really think, Charles had finished sixth in the qualifying. So we'd have to leapfrog one guy to pick Charles, who's still the best, going to be the best freshman in the country. So Mike Holder's kind of making Charles sweat. And then he looks over at me and he says, Coach McGraw, I'm going to let you make the decision.
Oh, no. Got put on the spot.
So I can feel Charles's eyes looking straight at me. I'm going, why in the world is he making me make this decision right now? And by the way, he and I had not even talked about it. And so I'm going, what does Mike want me to say? What does he want me to say? So I remembered something he had told me in June when I first went to work for him. He said, Coach McGraw, I don't care who it is, but pretty much if you play at Oklahoma State, the first time you play, you earn it the very first time. So I thought, okay, that's probably what he wants me to say. So I said, well, Coach, I think the first time that Charles plays, he ought to have to earn it. So I think we ought to take somebody else, whoever it was. And Charles Howell's just looking at me. He's glaring a hole right through me. And he turns to Mike Holder. He says, Coach, what are you going to do? And he says, well, I don't know. Coach McGraw's made his decision. And Charles looks at him and says, Coach Holder, he's just the assistant coach. You're the head coach. He's the lowly assistant coach. You're making the decision, aren't you?
Oh, man.
And I'm going, okay, I can't possibly win here. This is a terrible situation. What have I done? What's going on? So Coach Holder looks at him and says, Charles, don't sweat it out. We're going to pick you. You need to play for us to be our best team. You're going to be in the lineup. Don't worry about it. So Charles kind of slithered out of the office because he didn't want to have to deal with me at that point because he had just called me the assistant coach. And which I was. I mean, I'm not making any bones about it. So the next day, Charles is in having a sandwich at Carson Creek. And I sat down next to him, and he kind of looked up, and he put his head back down. And I said, hey, Charles, how you doing? He goes, fine, Coach. How was your morning? I said, well, it was a pretty good morning for an assistant coach. You know.
Oh, that's
great. He looked at me and he said, Coach, I'm so sorry. You just don't understand. I said, Charles, I understand completely. And I know my place. No big deal. So, and we laugh about that today. So he nicknamed me AC, or assistant coach. And Charles calls me AC to this day. So that was my favorite Charles Howell story, and happened on the first week I was at school. And there was a lot of other good ones too. But Ricky, I think my favorite story was not so much a funny story as just the way that Ricky in recruiting. So he originally had committed to UCLA and then he decommitted. And then, so I'm recruiting him in the summer of 2006 and I'm following him everywhere he goes that summer. And so I'm at the U.S. Junior. And then anyway, he qualified for the USAM. And so I'm at home. My assistant coach, Alan Bratton, is playing in the USAM. And so Alan missed the cut, so he's going to watch Ricky play match play, and Ricky's in the quarterfinals. So Ricky's just storming his way right through this tournament, playing great. In fact, he beat Pablo Martin, our best player at Oklahoma State, in a match the day before. But before the match play started, so it's before his first round, I'm in Stillwater, and I get a text on my BlackBerry. And I'd never received a photo on a text in a BlackBerry, so I didn't understand what it was. So I handed it to the assistant pro in the golf shop. I said, what is this? What is this? And so he opened it up, and the photo showed up on the screen of the phone. And it was Ricky standing there on the first tee at Hazeltine with a smile on his face and a Pistol Pete head cover on his driver. And that's all he sent. And the text was from Ricky. And so he teed off that day and won his match. And so I assume that was his way of committing verbally to Oklahoma State without doing it verbally. And anyway, so after the tournament, I called him and I said, Ricky, what does this mean? He says, oh, I'm an Oklahoma State Cowboy coach. And I go, how do I know you haven't told me that? And he said, no, that photo, that's what I'm telling you. You're not as smart as you look, coach. But anyway, he showed me he's a creative kid and a funny kid. He committed on it with a text message, just a video. He never actually verbally committed. He did it with a text message.
That sounds like a classic Ricky story there, Coach, for sure. And there's two other questions, or I guess points here. One, you know, do you have any other great stories, you know, just besides, you know, Charles and the Ricky stories that you share? Because I know you have at least one or two more stored up that, you know, stick out in your memory. And then the other one is definitely a story I want you to get to. We were told by our last week's guest, Kelsey and Taylor, to ask you about the year that you coached the women's team and y'all got to take a private jet for one of the tournaments.
Yeah, that's great. That's a good story. I will tell that story quickly. So more specifically, like, what stories are you thinking about relative to just coaching in general, or?
Yeah, so some good player stories, maybe some guys you had come in and you really had to change the way they thought on the course, or, you know, something funny that happened between you and one of your players on the course, in a hotel, on a jet, in any of those types of things.
Let me think on that one for a second while I tell you the other story. Is that okay?
Absolutely, yeah. Let's hear what happened on the jet.
Okay, well, when I was a women's coach, the men's team actually owned a fractional ownership of a Lear 45. And so I told Mike Holder we were going to be coming back from Palos Verdes, California, so Southern California. We couldn't make a flight out that day, so we'd have to miss another day of school. So I said, can I buy some hours from the men's team? He said, fine, great, we'll have it all set up. So it was all set up. So I took the team out to California. We flew out commercially, and I told them that, you know, we were going to be flying back privately. And so I had two first-team All-Americans. I had Annie Young and Karin Sodine, and those two girls were first-team All-Americans, and we ended up finishing 13th out of 15 teams with two first-team All-Americans, which is literally impossible. You can't do it. So that's how poorly we actually played. And so the girls are out in the parking lot, and I thank the tournament officials and everything, and we're going to go meet this private plane. And the girls have all of their bags strewn out in the parking lot, and they're putting makeup on, and they're just doing all kinds of stuff to get prim and proper and just right for this private flight, and they're all excited. And I said, put your stuff in the van. Coach, we don't have any deadlines. We don't have to make a flight. Those pilots can wait. And I thought, So I start throwing bags in the van. I just throw them all in there, slam the doors, get in the van, we're going. So we're driving. And one of the girls, she taps me on the shoulder and says, as I'm driving to the private airport flight, and she says, Coach McGraw, I just want you to know, we did our very best out there today. Oh, now I'm not happy.
Oh, God.
Don't tell me it was your best and you're putting makeup on in the parking lot and all smiling and having a good time. This is supposed to hurt a little bit. So we get in this private plane and we're getting ready to head back to Stillwater. We get up to cruising altitude, and I had ordered catering for the plane. And so once we get up to cruising altitude, I served everybody in the plane their food, their sandwiches and their Cokes and chips and whatever. And up front with me were the two first-team All-Americans. The other three girls were in the back. And so I'm getting ready to sit down and actually take a bite of my sandwich. And all I hear from behind me is, this is terrible, a cold sandwich. And so I am... so angry at this point. I'm thinking, man, we have lost perspective. This is really bad. But I didn't say anything right there because I thought I would kind of say something I shouldn't. So I got home that evening, and we were home by 6:30, and the girls had time to make their tutor appointments and, you know, easily rested and ready for school the next day, and we didn't miss any more school. But I'm venting to my wife, so upset. I'm just venting. And so after about 10 minutes, she says, why don't you do this? When I get really mad at you, I usually go write my feelings down on paper. So I thought, okay. So I went in there, I typed up this long document about why college golf is the greatest experience in the world, why it's a privilege, why people have sacrificed for you, donors have paid money, There's all these great things from equipment companies. I went through a litany of different unbelievable things about college golf, typed it up, made 6 copies. At the very bottom of this copy, it said, oh, and by the way, flying home on a Learjet is a privilege. It's not a right. And so I took 6 copies. We went to a team meeting the next day, passed it out. I said, nobody's speaking. You're just going to read this document silently as I read it aloud. We read it to them. They signed it. We went to practice. So a few days later, I was handing out our itinerary for the next tournament, which was in Austin, Texas. And on the itinerary, it said 2 things. 1, no headphones this trip. We're going to talk to each other. And 2, we're going to leave from the Stillwater Airport. Well, they were excited because if we left for the Stillwater Airport, that meant we were going to go to Oklahoma City from there in a van, fly in a commercial flight, and then fly back privately to the Stillwater Airport. That's what they thought. So I'm driving the van toward the Oklahoma City Airport, and I missed the exit for the Oklahoma City Airport. And remember, no headphones. And I've got George Jones, Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, all my dad's country music in there playing loudly. And one of the girls taps me on the shoulder, and I turn down the music, and I said, what can I help you with? And she says, Coach, you missed the turn for the Oklahoma City Airport. And I said, did? Huh. I guess we'll just drive. And then I just turned the music up and drove 55 miles an hour all the way to Austin, Texas. So it took us 10 and a half hours. And we stopped one time in Dallas to eat. And I pulled into a Subway and put the car in park, turned the van off, and I looked in the rearview mirror. And that girl who had griped about the cold sandwich on that Learjet 2.5 weeks earlier, I looked her straight in the eye and I said, oh, Candy, by the way, they're now toasting their sandwiches at Subway, so you'll get a warm sandwich here. And they did not say another word about cold sandwiches, I can tell you that. And we did finish one shot behind Duke, who won the national championship that year at that tournament in Austin. A month later, we won the conference championship, and then we finished 7th at Nationals. So we got her attention. She understood that it was about a little bit more than about flying on a plane and that you should get some perspective. And she did. And anyway, so I don't really have a lot of stories just off the top of my head relative to guys at tournaments through the years, other than you look back on it, you think to yourself, wow, what an experience. I get to do this, and they're paying me to do this, and it's just amazing that they allow me to continue to coach at the collegiate level. It's so much fun to help guys chase their dreams. I don't know if I have any other stories. I'd have to think about it. Maybe one will pop in my head before we're done.
Yeah, so I'm curious then, Coach. You know, you've gotten to see a lot of great golf courses over your time, obviously at Oklahoma State and then now at Baylor. And like you said, you fly all over the place, Florida, California. You mentioned Cabo. What are some of the best courses that you've gotten to go to, that you've gotten to experience? I don't know. I'm sure through being a Division I collegiate head coach, you've gotten to play some pretty phenomenal courses. So what are some of the best golf courses that your coaching career has taken you to?
Well, 2 of them are very close by Oklahoma. One of them is Prairie Dunes, which is in Hutchinson, Kansas. I think
was the
Prairie Dunes
2014 national championship. Is that right?
Yes, and we play the conference championship there as well sometimes. But to me, Prairie Dunes has the greatest green complexes in the United States of America. They are amazing, and it's just the length of it, it's a very short golf course by modern day standards. If the wind blows at all, it's still got as much teeth as any championship course anywhere. So I think Prairie Dunes is, quite frankly, an amazing honor to get to go and walk around that place. I always have thought that. I always will think that. It's my favorite place on planet Earth. It's just an amazing golf course. So Prairie Dunes would be 1 on my list. Southern Hills in Tulsa. And we were to play the conference championship later this month. We're not going to get to there. I love Southern Hills. I think its history is amazing. It's hosted a U.S. Junior, a U.S. Amateur, a U.S. Women's Open, a U.S. Open, a PGA Championship, a Tour Championship. And so it's hosted about as many different types of championships as any golf course in the country. Again, doesn't have what you'd think of as incredible length, but it plays very, very long and has tremendous green complexes. Again, they're amazing. Beautiful big trees, lots of rolling hills. My dad was an assistant pro there in the early 50s, so I've always had an affinity for it. But once I got to play it and walk around that golf course, I think I've been around it now 150 times as a player or coach. So I love Southern Hills, and that's just right there in Tulsa. And then another place I really love is Chicago, called Olympia Field, where Jim Furyk won his U.S. Open back in 2003. And we play the Fighting Illini there every year. And I absolutely am in love with that place as well. So those are all different types of golf courses. One is very hilly. That's Southern Hills with tree lined and big trees. One is kind of a Lynx type golf course, Prairie Dunes. And the other is Olympia Fields, which is huge, huge golf course, but with big trees, but pretty flat. So, but all three amazing golf courses.
Yeah. Southern Hills is my favorite course and that I've ever been able to play myself to. And Prairie Dunes, too. Perry Maxwell designed courses, a lot of his famous courses around this area, and one of, if not one of at least top three best architects of all time. And, you know, now that we've been able to talk some of the courses that you've been able to go around and see, Coach, I'm just curious, you know, from all of your player experience, whether it be coaching or just viewership, what are some of the, you know, like the best ball strike you've seen during this time, or the best putter that you've seen during your time? And kind of what made them so? Was it their work ethic, or was it just the confidence they had, or was it something technique-wise that they did to make them that good?
Well, I think as far as just the best technique, I would have to go with Charles Howell. I think Charles worked on technique so much, and kind of an anomaly, because a lot of people who work on technique aren't necessarily, I mean, that's all they work on is technique, aren't necessarily great players or great ball strikers. Charles is. I mean, if every year they, or every few years, they poll the PGA Tour players themselves, and amongst your peers, who is the best ball striker? And Charles Howell almost always heads that list, even today at age 40 or 41. He's just an amazing, technique is so perfect. He literally has a great command and control of the golf ball. So I would have to say Charles Howell as far as players I've coached. The best ball striker, that'd be the person who, and when I say ball striker, that's somebody who can be a great shot maker as well and hit every shot in the book and can do all those things, would be Ricky Fowler. Ricky just had all the shots. I never backed him off of a golf shot, not one time in his 2 years that he was at Oklahoma State. He said he thought he could hit a shot. I wanted to see it. So I'd have to consider him the best ball striker I ever saw. Best short game would be Sean Einhaus. Sean, if you guys were around in the 2011 NCAA championship at Carson Creek, he's the one that made that dramatic putt against Augusta State to send the match to a playoff. But Sean literally had a world-class short game all through college. And he was struggling with his ball striking in college, so, you know, many times he was scrambling to save pretty solid rounds. But he had a short game that would literally stun opposing coaches. They could not fathom the shots he was hitting, and I just sat back and smiled because it was pretty fun to watch the shots he could hit around green.
That's great stuff. Hey, Coach Mike McGraw here with us on the 73rd hole. Coach, I got a couple of fun ones I want to get to you before we get out of here. We had Taylor Gooch on, like we talked about last week. Taylor Gooch and Kelsey Klein joined us, and one of the things they told us to ask you about was your eating speed and your love for ice cream. Apparently, according to them, you would get ice cream and you'd be back up getting seconds and thirds before anybody else was through the line. So what is it about your eating speed and ice cream?
Well, as I once told Zach Robinson, who played for me at Oklahoma State, who fancied himself a really fast eater, I said, Zach, in the world of competitive eating, I'm Jack Nicklaus and you're Fred Funk. Now, Fred Funk's pretty good, but he's not Jack Nicklaus. So now that's a little bit cocky and arrogant. I apologize for that. But I really am a fast eater. And I credit having grown up in a family with seven children. You got as much food as you could, as fast as you could, hoping there would be more. And so I still, that's kind of ingrained in me. I've never lost that. My wife and I have eaten about two meals together in our entire marriage because I'm done by the time she's putting, you know, salt and pepper on her food, I'm finished. So we never get to eat meals together. So I'm very fast. And speed eating relative to ice cream, since I don't get brain freezes, I can eat ice cream as fast as I can get it down. You know, as fast as I can get the ice cream in my mouth, I'm so if unless you don't get brain freezes, I'm going to destroy you in ice cream eating. Really, I don't really understand that, even though I'm not eating much ice cream these days. Right now I'm not, but there's not a lot of restaurants open with them.
Right.
So, yeah, really fast in both areas. And I've been challenged by about every fast eater I've ever had. And Zach Robinson is one of the only two guys who've ever beaten me. And he beat me by one piece of steak on a 33-ounce steak. We both ate an identical. he beat me by one piece. So
who was really the other one? You said you've been beaten twice. Who was the other one who beat you?
Trey Mullinax from Alabama, who's on the PGA Tour now. He beat me eating this pizza, and I was stunned. I guess I didn't pay attention. And the guy on our current team that really should be able to beat me, but I just don't think he wants to work on his skills, is Colin Cover, one of our team captains. Really a fast eater, but he doesn't seem to he's not taking it seriously.
Yeah, you got to have the commitment and the dedication whenever it comes to speed eating. All right, and then the other thing that we were told to ask you about was you coached Kevin Tway, who obviously is the son of Bob Tway, who won the PGA Championship back in the day. And apparently Kevin Tway made a comment about Bob winning the PGA. What is that story about Kevin talking about his dad's success?
Well, actually, that can't be on. We can't put that one on this podcast. I apologize.
No, you're all right. But, we were told to ask you about it. I didn't realize it was out there in left field. But I'm assuming you had some good times with Kevin Tway talking about his dad. We can probably just leave it at that.
Yeah, Kevin he's really a fantastic guy. Kevin's quite frankly, a quiet guy and seems to be really shy. But once you get to know Kevin, he's absolutely a gem. He's unbelievable. So if you get to know him, you're going to love him.
Is he the biggest bomber you've ever coached? Guys who can just hit it a mile?
Yeah, as far as just easy speed, it doesn't look like he's not trying to get much out there yet. He's a bomber. He kills it, and he's not even trying. It's just so talented. His freshman year, we were at Inverness. Sophomore year, we were at Inverness, and Bob was up there watching us play a practice round. And that's where Bob won the PGA. And there was this par three that was a 225, 230 into the breeze. And Kevin laced a 3-iron in there about 10 feet from the hole. And I looked at Bob and I said, Bob, when's the last time you hit a golf shot like that? And he says, Coach, I've never hit a shot like that. So, like, I know Kevin's a lot better than I am. There's just, you know, it's just time will tell for Kevin. Kevin's a fantastic guy. Really, really fun.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Can't repeat that story, though.
Yeah, no, that's all right. That's quite all right. You've given us plenty of gold as far as the stories go on today's show. And, Coach, you've been phenomenal. We really appreciate your time, and we hope to do it again sometime. Try not to go crazy in this extended off season.
All right, guys. Thanks so much for having me on. Best of luck with everything.
Thank you so much.
That's current Baylor and former Oklahoma State head coach Mike McGraw joining us here on the 73rd hole. Fantastic stuff from Coach McGraw. Make sure you find all of our podcasts, The 73rd Hole. You can listen on Apple, Spotify, Google, and head over, hit us up on social media. On Twitter, at The 73rd Hole. Instagram is just 73rd Hole. And then Facebook is The 73rd Hole Podcast. Make sure you like, follow on all of those pages. And make sure you rate and subscribe this podcast wherever you may be listening. A lot of good stuff coming your way on social media, so make sure you check those out. And we appreciate everyone listening once again to another edition of the 73rd Hole.